Welcome back, folks. Just when he thought he was out, we're pulling him back in. We can't let him go. Don Dubuque, former WWL Outdoor Show host. Don, welcome to the show.
Hey, Noel, glad to talk to you, my friend.
Hope you're enjoying your retirement, my friend, and hope things are going well.
Well, I found out the meaning of that phrase from retired people you hear often when they say, I think I have to go back to work to get some rest. I now understand what they mean by that.
Absolutely. Well, we could think of no better person than to talk to you about what the heck is going on with all of these recent black bear sightings on the North Shore.
Well, they've been growing over the past few years, and there's really a couple things responsible for that. And mainly, it's the comeback, the wonderful story of the comeback of the black bear in Louisiana. You know, back in the 1700s, when they were first recording exploration of the United States and in the Louisiana Territory, they encountered black bears. There were plenty of them back then. And then they started deciding they needed to start working on them. And believe me, they went through the bears. There's one record of an ex-slave who turned into professional bear guide. In fact, he was the one that guided Teddy Roosevelt on his famous Louisiana bear hunt. And he was responsible personally for either killing himself or having people he brought 3,000 bears in Louisiana. It was big
wow.
Business, big time. And we brought them to the brink of extinction, to the point where they became an endangered species and were listed on the federal endangered list. And I can recall the excitement back in 1967, I think it was, when all the hype about the Minnesota Bears are coming, the Minnesota Bear, and people thought it was a football team. But it was actually the importation of 161 bears that were trapped in Minnesota, brought to Louisiana, released here as a restocking program. And, of course, we did have a few bears remaining, native Louisiana species, and I don't know what the extent of the interbreeding was with the Minnesota bears because they were a little bit different. They were larger bears and had a little bit different head shapes to them. But all in all, through the protection programs, putting them off limits, instituting $10,000 fines for killing black bears, they have come back, and largely due in part to the work of our Louisiana Department of Wildlife and Fishery, the people who joined the nonprofit Louisiana-backed black bear restoration programs. And it's been a raging success to the point now where we have such a population that it warrants bringing back limited hunting seasons, restricted hunting seasons on them. And actually, they're starting to become problematic. There's so many in some areas. Now, as far as here on the North Shore, right here where I live, I back up to a hunting lease, and we've got cameras. And that's the thing, that these are being documented more precisely now, because all the hunting club people have trail cameras all over their property, and they pick up the bears when they come to the deer feeders. This time of the year is when they're going to be most prevalent. You really don't see a lot of bears in the fall, in winter, and early spring in this part of the state. But due to this being the June being the prime mating season, that's when they get on the move. And they travel hundreds of miles following corridors. The Pearl River Basin is one. The Atchafalaya is the other. And because of their sheer numbers, they're starting to spill over into the Florida parishes, Tangipahoa, Washington, St. Tammany. They're becoming very, very common. They're getting in people's garbage cans. In some areas in North Louisiana, around Tensaw and down in St. Mary Parish in the lower Atchafalaya, they've become problematic to the point where people are really complaining about them. So the state decided to institute these limited and highly restricted hunting seasons, which have been very successful, and people who now have a dream that the bear is one of the animals they want to pursue, they can certainly do it, but it's done by a highly regulated lottery and some pretty tough restrictions as far as the manner of take and where you can take them and when you can take them and what exact members of the species you can take.
Yeah. Don, all the time that you've spent hunting in Louisiana, Mississippi, and otherwise, have you seen a black bear?
I have in person only seen two live black bears in Louisiana. One was standing on the side of the highway, and at first I mistook it for a dog. like, you know, one of these Rottweilers, because they look about the same color. And this one was fairly good size. And when I got up close to it and passed it, I realized it was a black bear. That was on the highway that connects Morgan City to the West Bank. And then I saw one on Yancey Wildlife Management Area. I was up there one summer. I was scouting for some woodcock hunting areas, and we encountered one there. The only other time I've seen them live is I spent some time up in Gatlinburg, up in the mountains there,
yeah.
And they came through our yards up there. They're very, very common up there. But it's really a thing to behold to be able to see a black bear in the wild.
It's funny, I was on a phone with a friend who was coming back from North Louisiana, and you mentioned Tensaw Parish, and he was driving through Tensaw Parish. He goes, "Newell, I just saw a bear cross right in front of me on the highway." You know, and he's like, he could tell he was kind of shocked by it. And I heard him on the phone, like the car, you know, the cadence of the engine slow down. And he's like, "I just saw a bear. I just saw a bear."
Well, it does kind of take your breath away. Of course, the people that live in those highly populated areas, they're to the point where they're almost a nuisance to them. They're raiding their garbage cans. A lot of them are beekeepers. And I'm not sure what it is that drives them to do that, but I can remember being at a Wildlife and Fishery Commission meeting, and there were some farmers from central Louisiana that were testifying that the bears actually destroyed their equipment. They were tearing the hoses open to get at, I don't remember if it was transmission fluid or the oil in there. There was something that they were in there eating and destroying their equipment, and they were asking for an abundance of more permits than what they had been issued to kind of control them a little better.
So if you're blazing a trail, you're running a trail, or anything else, what should people know about a black bear? I mean, all these different species of bears, they all kind of act differently, right?
Yeah, the Louisiana black bear is nothing like the grizzly or the brown bear that you might encounter up in Canada or Alaska or some of the northern states. Black bears, a lot of people refer them to an oversized black possum. I mean, they behave similarly. You know, they're very secretive. They really don't. If you encounter one in the woods, they're going to run. They're going to turn and run. They have a natural fear of humans. The only time it can really get dangerous if one is cornered, particularly if you encounter a female with cubs, she could be very aggressive. And believe me, in a fight between a bear and a human, the bear's going to win. But for the most part, if you happen to be in the woods and you see a bear, try to get a picture of it. You know, just don't make any noise. Don't approach it. Don't try to feed it. Certainly don't try to pet it. That's not a good idea. And they're basically going to walk off and leave you alone.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, Don. I'm sure you've seen these videos of people, walking up to a bison or whatever it may be that they're in, some national park. And, like, I love up in Estes Park, people are walking up to full-grown elk, 6x6, you know, or 7x7, massive bull elk, walking up to them like they're a pet. It's like, what are you doing? Get the heck away.
You know, I call that the Walt Disney theory on animal behavior. People who don't have any natural experience in the real world of the woods and the swamps and the marshes and the waters, they sometimes have this totally different view of how animals behave. And we got to remember, these are wild creatures, wild critters, and you got to respect the way they behave. You can't just go up to them and pet them and get in the way, and a lot of people get injured like that, particularly up in Yellowstone. I've been up there, and I mean, those herds of bison are just crossing the road right in front of your car, and the best thing to do, don't get out.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how they do that. Well, Don, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll hear more about it. I was shocked to hear the distance that they will travel while mating, while looking for a mate. I mean, they'll cover a significant amount of territory in one day.
Yeah, and they can track them very easily now because of the radio telemetry. They'll find the bears in their dens when they're semi-hibernating, or they will encounter them, trap them, tranquilize them, and they will insert these radio collars in them, and they can track them. And I can recall one bear that crossed not only did he come across the Pearl River, but he went west. He crossed the Mississippi River into West Louisiana, turned around and went all the way back to Mississippi as they tracked them. So they like those corridors, and that's what we have in Louisiana, is the huge Atchafalaya that runs north-south, and then on a smaller scale, the Pearl River Basin, and it gives them wild areas that they can traverse on those long trips that they make. And, you know, it's just incredible to see some of the distances that they will travel.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Don, thank you so much.
Those collars, there was, I can know at least one instance where somebody illegally shot a bear. He skinned the bear. He put it in his freezer, but he didn't know that the collar was in there. And it led the agents right to his freezer door. They tracked the GPS on the radio collar.
Bear? What bear? What are you talking about, a bear? I don't know anything about a bear. Yeah, well, let's go check your freezer. I say this all the time. Those that perpetrate crimes, thankfully, for the most part, they're a little dumb.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Well, Don, as always, truly enjoy the conversation. Glad that things are going well for you. I guess the list of things that you have to do is growing by the day. I've experienced that myself, so I know what you're talking about.
Well, keep up the good work, Dan Newell. You do a heck of a job, and I'm someone that can attest to it because I filled in for you on many occasions, and I understand what it takes to do the job that you do, and a lot of people don't appreciate it, but they should, and keep it up.
Thank you, sir. Don Dubuque, former WWL Outdoor Show host. We will be right back, folks. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Well, folks, there's some studies out. They're preliminary. They're new about whether or not these GLP-1 drugs may help reshape some of their patients' brains. Well, it caught my attention because there's a couple of things I would like to reshape in my brain. Dr. Gil Hebert is here to talk to us about it, assistant professor of medicine at Tulane University. It looks like, Doc, some of this reshaping is actually a positive thing.
Yeah, Noel, nice to chat with you. I think this is something that from obesity medicine and the study of metabolism and weight regulation in the brain could be expected, but obviously, like you said, there's a little more research needed to understand the full extent of this.
So what did these early onset studies, what did they reveal specifically?
So I think, you know, we understand the pathophysiology of appetite dysregulation as it contributes to obesity and the areas of the brain that are affected. And, you know, this study in particular, what they're really looking at is, you know, it's a small study, but placing people, you know, teens and adolescents on these medications for other reasons, you know, for metabolic reasons, are they seeing changes on MRIs that correlate with certain areas of the brain that are in charge of regulating, you know, attention, maybe mood, impulse control, that kind of stuff.
Are you surprised by this connection or not so much?
I mean, not so much. I think, you know, like I said, I think the specifics of it, maybe there's a little more to shine some light on. But, you know, I tell patients this every day, you know, obesity as a disease is incredibly complex, and it's not one thing that is happening to a person that contributes to their obesity, the same way many other chronic diseases. There's not one thing typically. So to speak of it in these isolations would be tough. But what I see in a lot of patients who use these medications to treat their diabetes or treat their obstructive sleep apnea, or treat their obesity, is they report, you know, other effects from the medicine, which include, they go, wow, I just, you know, the choices I'm making in my life are a little bit different. I've always wanted to make healthier choices, and now it doesn't seem like that's so difficult. You know, their attention is a little bit different. Their focus may be a little bit different. So I'm not totally surprised.
When we talk about obesity in general, I'm kind of, and this is going to sound like a weird question, but on a scale to 1 to 10, 10 being, you know, a lot. How much do we actually know physiologically how obesity affects the body in its totality?
I would say we know quite a lot. You know, not quite a 10. I don't think we're perfect yet, but we're certainly, I would think, you know, above a 6 or a 7, venturing onto an 8. You know, we understand the effects of obesity, and we understand both in the brain and in the body. So I always tell patients, we understand the neurohormonal consequences, and we understand some of the physiologic consequences, what your brain and your body are doing. The question that we're getting into is, can we target therapies more and more directed at specific organ systems instead of taking more of a 30,000-foot approach to the problem? And that's where I think a lot of the clinical research is pushing toward.
And is that accomplished also by prescribing different types of drugs at the same time as well?
Sometimes. So I think we say this a lot in obesity medicine. The approach is not a one-size-fits-all. It should be tailored to the patient sitting in front of us. There's lots of considerations of, like, what other medications are these people on? Are there medications that we know are what we call obesogenic? They can promote weight gain. Are there issues there? Are there kind of, you know, psychosocial issues? Are there behavioral issues involved? And just other health consequences? Are there other medical problems that contribute to their weight gain? And so sometimes we're talking about changing, you know, a class of medication that they're on to treat a different problem that we go, oh, this actually can assist a little bit with weight loss. It may not be as effective as some of these second-generation anti-obesity medicines. But we do use kind of combinations of different therapies and kind of moving some things around to see if we can tailor the treatment to the patient.
Doc, if you would, for the benefit of the listening audience, you know, we talk about GLP-1 drugs. A lot of folks are asking, what are those? You know, what are they by name? So I guess Ozempic would be one, maybe Wegovy. Are there others?
Yeah, there are. There's a handful now. There are some still older versions that have been around for a little over 20 years now. They've, you know, fallen out of favor a little bit. But many people may not have realized they had been on these. So some of them, you know, there are medication names and brand names. So exenatide, liraglutide, dulaglutide, these are things like Saxenda and Victoza that have been around in the diabetes world, like I said, for about 20 plus years. And when I think of GLP-1 classes of medicines, really they're all fall under sort of a peptide class, or that's what they are, to say that the way that insulin in our body is a peptide. But there is the diabetes forms or the FDA indications for diabetes and those that are indicated for weight management or other secondary benefits. So that's things like Ozempic is a diabetes medication, Mounjaro is a diabetes medication, and those drugs are also Wegovy and Zepbound. And there's a slightly newer medication that is a small molecule of GLP called Foundayo or Orforglipron.
Are there significant differences between those brands?
So they all sort of fall under the same class of medication. And there are differences in the sense of what were the drugs studied for, maybe as secondary benefits, which a lot of times that's how these medications are covered. And when we compare them, so for instance, semaglutide, which is the drug ingredient that is in Ozempic and Wegovy, is a GLP-1 only medication, whereas Mounjaro and Zepbound, which is tirzepatide is the actual name of the medicine, that's a dual receptor GLP-GIP medication. So it's not two medications put together, it's actually a different peptide that's been formulated. So they have slight differences, but overall have similar effects.
Yeah. And so I guess these studies that we're talking about, I guess it's hard to just generalize then across the GLP ones about this secondary benefits that people may be having from, because I guess it would be more unique to each individual brand, maybe?
It might be. I kind of tell patients, you know, it's a lot of the effects that we know from these medications, a lot of it's probably class specific, because they're still, you know, acting on the same, on similar receptors in similar parts of the body. And it's probably more of an effect size for some people. And we know that people are just biologically diverse. So you have patients who go, look, I've tried this and it really gave me none of the effect that other people mention. And we might try a different medication that's in the same class, and they go, oh, wow, nope, this is the one. This works so much better. And that's something that we don't understand yet. We don't have that crystal ball or that test to give them before and go, oh, we know this is the medication that'll work best for you.
Is there, folks are asking, is there a difference in the administration and the effects based on gender?
So there's actually some interesting data around this. So method of administration is really either injection, subcutaneous injection with a very small needle, or there are oral options available. For the closest comparison would be the Wegovy injection versus the Wegovy tablet. And in the trial data, we saw that they were pretty much the exact same outcomes. It's a, probably more of a question of adherence in the real world of do people miss doses or not, because it is a daily pill compared to a weekly injection. And then there's some interesting data around comparing men and women. And actually, on average, women seem to respond better to the medications overall. Now, is it, you know, statistically and clinically significant? Maybe not so much, but you know, a lot of times we do have issues where things are studied, you know, much more in men than in women. But in fact, for these types of medications, more of the data is coming from women.
And is that just, you know, I find my wife is more, you know, when it comes to medication, she's a lot better at strict adherence than I am.
Sure. I won't single anybody out, but I think anecdotally we would say that may be true in the medical industry as well. Women are typically maybe a little bit better patients.
Yeah. Doc, final thoughts?
I will say this. I deal with these medications almost every day of the week, I say this over and over again. We're going to continue to learn more and more about them. And I think if somebody qualifies for them, you know, seek the advice of your doctor. And if need be, try to get out there and see a specialist who really understands these medications and can help treat the diseases that they're intended to treat.
Forgive me. I wanted to ask one more question that just kind of popped into my head. You know, this is a relatively, I guess, for the most part, a new drug that's been on, you know, it's been on the market a little bit, but it's relatively new. How would you characterize the impact of this on society? I mean, obesity's been growing in this country for, you know, decades. And when you think about the secondary and you know, and other levels of impact, that this has led to in the administration of these drugs. I mean, how would you characterize the impact to society?
I mean, I think this is going to be a turning point in a bit of medical world history. Now, that's my bias. I think I was very lucky to kind of come up in this time where we have the ability to legitimately treat patients who are struggling with obesity, and many of them for their entire lives. And related to these medications, we actually, for the first time, really have effective medications to treat monogenic causes of obesity. you know, this that's a totally different battle. And even these medications don't really affect that so much. And so we finally have other things. And so I think if I were to fast forward 10 years, I think similar to things like statins and antihypertensives and stuff, the stigma around these medications will fall to the wayside, and we will be much more accepting in using these much more broadly. And there's going to be more of them on the market, more refined targeted treatments. And it'll just be another tool in the toolbox for us to treat chronic disease.
You know, the skeptic side of me and the optimistic side of me, you know, these competing forces, as, you know, the acuity levels of certain ailments or illnesses that people have tied to obesity goes away. I mean, that kind of hurts the pharmaceutical industry in one way. And then the other thing is that, you know, we're just a healthier population as a result of all of this. And I mean, it's just you think about it in that respect, and it's huge. I mean, when we look at the amount of the population that's medically uninsured in this country, not able to deal with a bunch of these issues, as the cost of these drugs come down, I mean, the impact just will exponentially grow, right?
I think so, and I think it's something where when we're talking about sort of the economics of health, it's really hard to look at something and go, well, what happens in the next few months or the next quarter or the next year? It's really, what are we doing now? What interventions are we going to put in place so that, like you said, we have a healthier population in 10, 20, 30 years where we have people who they're living longer, but we want them to live longer with fewer ailments. We want them to be, you know, contributing members of society and able to enjoy themselves. And I think this is, again, just one of those steps in that direction. And the cost is something that'll be there, but it'll come down, I think, as more and more pharmaceutical companies get involved in this. And trust me, there are a lot of interest in this. And so almost every major pharmaceutical company is investing in expanding the options here.
Absolutely. Getting older is a struggle that nobody wants to have. As I attempted to get out of a beach chair the other day and was embarrassed by the attempt. It was horrible. But Dr. Gil Hebert, thank you so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time, your insight. Assistant Professor of Medicine at Tulane University. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Open Heart Jewelers Talk and text line. Stay with us. So there's been a case in Minnesota that's been brewing for a while. Chu Lu Vang, an illegal alien, in 2005 pled guilty to sexually abusing a 10-year-old girl. In a plea deal that kept him from going to prison and obviously getting deported, He pled guilty, and last month the Minnesota Board of Pardons granted him a reprieve, according to CBS News, after he submitted a letter expressing regret for what he did. The victim in the case actually forgave him, and also, I guess, is of majority now, and wrote a letter on his behalf. The Board of Pardons, which consisted of Governor Tim Walz, Attorney General Keith Ellison, and Supreme Court Justice Natalie Hudson, said they took the victim's statement into account. The problem here is he's still an illegal alien. The Department of Homeland Security released its own statement saying Governor Walz's decision to pardon this illegal alien convicted of child rape so he can remain in our country is disgusting. These are criminal illegal aliens, and they have utilized these sanctuary cities and states and protecting them. And I would agree. This dual system that we've set up in this country where we're protecting these individuals, forgetting the fact that there's still a criminal illegal alien here, and why should we protect them from being deported? Well, obviously the DOJ and the government and the federal government stepped in, and he will be deported as a result of their efforts. And actually, he has been deported, and he's no longer in this country. In another case where this is really interesting, too, any of us who have children college age, we know that there's this difference between in-state tuition and out-of-state tuition. And there's a whole host of rules that citizens have to comply with in order to be able to take advantage of in-state tuition. But not so fast. If you're an illegal alien coming across the border, you have the benefit of in-state tuition no matter where you decide to land. And in fact, a lot of the provisions in law did not apply to them. A lot of states got a little bit smart about this and started eliminating that practice because they recognize that this worked to the detriment of citizens in this country. And in fact, the Fifth Circuit, Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, has just upheld the end of in-state tuition for illegal aliens in the state of Texas on a 2-1 decision. Mind-numbing. That they, just because of their deciding where they want to land, and what is happening is they've actually had testimony that was provided, is that a lot of the immigrant activist groups are providing a menu of benefits state by state. And they're choosing on some of these states where they get the benefit of this in-state tuition. And they don't have to go through the same review that you or I and our kids would have to go through if they are, in fact, in-state versus out-of-state. Very interesting how we continue to set up this dual system. And people are offended by the fact that we believe that our citizenship should matter. That maybe we should have a citizen preference. Why should they get a preference and we don't, and we're not able to enjoy the same thing by being a citizen? I don't know about you, but I want the citizen preference. We'll be right back. On the text line, Newell, with the craziness in our world today, I sometimes have to pinch myself just to make sure I am not dreaming. How can anyone, much less a politician who is supposed to represent the best interests of the people, stand by or even worse, vote for some of the things with a good conscience? We are doomed as a society if we continue down this road. Newell, as a conservative and a lawyer, you should know what special benefit you can avail yourself of in accordance with the U.S. Constitution. Not so simple these days. There seems to be asterisks and exceptions made all the time that benefit folks that should have like no real expectation of things that they're going to receive. I don't remember anybody offering me, when I reached the age of majority, a free cell phone. I don't remember anybody putting me up in a hotel when I decided to move out of my parents' home. And I don't know that we offer citizens a sanctuary. Do you know of any? I don't. I'm just kind of curious. Where's our sanctuary? As some of our neighborhoods are crime-ridden, downtrodden, little or no infrastructure. Where's the sanctuary for those citizens? Do we know? I don't. I know it's not in the Constitution, but I don't know where it is either. The folks that make significant investments in their neighborhoods each and every day, working hard to provide the necessary sustenance for their family, and they hit tough times. Where's their sanctuary? Where's their free phone? Where's this? Where's that? I don't see it. I don't understand it. In this country, over 40% of the people live below the federally identified poverty level, and we're worrying about a lot of others as opposed to our own. That's the citizen privilege I'm talking about. Do you have confidence that your home and family will be okay when the storm hits and the power goes out? Don't get caught in the heat and the dark this summer. Wind backup power from WWL and Craig's Electrical and Generator. Scoot joins us. What do we have coming up, Scoot?
The Rolling Stones have released another studio album. It came out today.
Wow.
We're going to sample some of that, and we'll talk about the difference between lying and just being dishonest, and we'll talk about movies that every young person should see.
Absolutely. Scoot's up next, folks. Have a great weekend. We'll see you again Monday morning.